wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is a listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this February 4th Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com. This morning on The Old Mole, Laurie Mercier talks with Ian Urquhart. He's the author of the recent book Costly Fix, Power, Politics, and Nature in the Tar Sands. Ian Urquhart is a professor of political science at the University of Alberta, and they discuss the post-1995 Alberta tar sands boom and how the state inflated the profitability of the tar sands, turning a blind eye to environmental issues. Bill Resnick interviews Kathy Wells. Wells has been organizing and managing the build-out of Lancaster, California's public community energy system that is moving towards zero carbon, including transportation. Lancaster is 60 miles northeast of Los Angeles. We'll conclude the program this morning with Norm Diamond, who's revisiting the 1919 Seattle General Strike with guest Rob Rosenthal. He's the composer of the mid-1980s rock opera Seattle 1919. For many years, Rob Rosenthal taught a course at Wesleyan University in Connecticut on music and social movements. He will be in the Pacific Northwest for the Labor History Conference on May 3rd through 5th. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and thanks for tuning in this morning. Thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting KBOO and programs like The Old Mole. Now we'll turn to Laurie Mercier and Ian Urquhart. Laurie?
Thanks, Denise. Well, as you heard, Ian Urquhart is a professor of political science at University of Alberta, co-author of The Last Great Forest, Japanese Multinationals and Alberta's Northern Forests, the former editor of the Wildlands Advocate, the Alberta Wilderness Association's news journal, and the subject of our discussion today, the recent and important book he authored, Costly Fix, Power, Politics, and Nature in the Tar Sands. Welcome to KBOO, Ian.
Oh, thanks. Thanks very much, Laurie. It's a real honor to be part of this wonderful radio station this morning.
Thanks. Okay, so since most of us here look north to Canada for examples of sanity, clearly, as your book Costly Fix identifies, there the oil industry and elected officials are together hastening the global climate disaster. Let's start with what happened in the 1990s when the Canadian state began to support tar sands expansion. Why did it?
It's a fundamental question, and I think that actually what was taking place in Canada and Alberta in the 1990s was really a version of what we saw in other jurisdictions around the world. We saw it in Thatcher's United Kingdom. We saw it in Reagan's America. And I think what we really saw happening at that particular time was how a particular idea becomes embedded in political institutions, as well as in mainstream political parties and the groups who want to influence government, and that it becomes obvious to this particular idea what position government should take relative to an industry like the petroleum industry. The idea that the phrase that I use in the book is market fundamentalism, which comes from Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel-winning economist. And Stiglitz describes market fundamentalism as really being the prevailing religion in the West for at least a generation now. And I think he's absolutely right about that. And what happened in Alberta and in the U.S., people like Fred Block and Margaret Summers have examined this market fundamentalism phenomenon in the U.S. And what happened in Canada and in Alberta was to some extent a deregulation of markets, what we associate with neoliberalism. But there was also a very important re-regulation that went on at this particular time. And this was a re-regulation that essentially made it much more profitable for the tar sands principals to engage in that particular type of very ecologically destructive petroleum extraction.
Well, let's talk about this market fundamentalism, because even though its proponents and its propaganda would like us to imagine that it's the free market at work,
right,
as your book points out, it's the state and state intervention that makes this profiteering possible. So tell us more about that in relation to the tar sands context.
Sure, absolutely. And it is that notion of re-regulation that is so important. So what we had in Canada in the 1980s was an industry in its infancy that, contrary to the conventional wisdom in the business press, was actually quite profitable. But what we had happen in the 1990s was a right-of-center government come to power in Alberta that essentially saw no value in the resource other than trying to accelerate its development as quickly as possible. We saw a failure on the part of government to realize that in those times it had important bargaining chips that it could have been employed against the petroleum industry, political stability. Look at Venezuela, an educated, trained labor force, access to the U.S. market, those sorts of things. But this notion that the state should really be the servant of industry was, it became the norm not only in the right of center parties, but even among the center left parties like the New Democrats and the Liberals. The notion that they should support industry, try to increase their profitability. We see it now. I mean, this notion of re-regulation is something that we're seeing today, where, you know, what does the Canadian government do with respect to tar sands production? Well, we run out and buy a pipeline for over $4 billion, even in Canadian dollars. That's an impressive piece of change. What do? We curtail oil production in order to try to make the industry more profitable than it otherwise would be. The Premier of Alberta has announced that she wants to buy over $1 billion in rail cars to, again, what's the point of that? It's to support the industry. So we've lived in this time for, you know, going on a generation now.
Well, of course, just the fact that the NDP is behaving this way is very disappointing for our American listeners. The New Democratic Party in Canada represents the left of center party, left of the Democratic Party in the U.S., and yet it is also embracing this kind of market fundamentalism. So how did the petroleum or fossil fuels industries, how did they capture Canadian government at the provincial and federal levels?
Yeah, like in terms, it would be a mistake for me to suggest that the history of oil in Canada as a history where we've seen government standing up to the oil industry. I mean, that hasn't been the case. So the sort of exceptional boom that began in the 1990s was to some degree a continuation or an exaggeration of what had existed previously in Canada. But importantly, in the 1970s, we had at the provincial level and at the federal level, we had governments that were prepared to challenge industry over questions like what share of natural resource wealth should private corporations get relative to the public treasury. So we had that. We had that taking place in the 1970s and the early part of the 1980s. But since that point of time, those sorts of views have vanished from the mainstream political spectrum in Canada. As you pointed out, we have a left of center provincial government here in Alberta that has really behaved exactly as its predecessors, its more conservative administrations, more Republican-like administrations, behaved in the 1980s, 90s, and first decade of this century.
Well, that's kind of a depressing reality, this market fundamentalism's hegemonic control over all political parties. But I don't think, I mean, I think you show there's evidence that not everyone has bought into this because, of course, Trudeau campaigned in 2015 on this promise of curtailing the pipeline that Kinder Morgan was proposing, and then, as you show, he ends up spending Canadian dollars to purchase it.
Right. Well, I mean, I think one lesson from all of this, and this is for my American friends as well as people in this country, is one of the things we really like in terms of thinking about as an activist. I mean, how are we going to deal with this? How many are we going to deal with this situation? I think the first step is whether you want to be involved in formal party politics or politics outside of mainstream political parties. I think the first thing that you have to do is be skeptical of just about everything the government tells you. The now infamous phrase fake news. This is something that government more often than not is responsible for, not newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post, etc. So I think, in sort of thinking, what do we do with these sorts of situations? One of the ways we should try to address it is in our skepticism. Other ways that we have to try to identify and follow are identifying those sorts of institutional settings where it's possible to express these voices in a way that have real meaning. One of the things, for example, that was important in the opposition to the tar sands was the debate over Keystone XL in the U.S. during the Obama administration. And activists who were concerned about what's being done to the planet through tar sands were able to use features of the American political system in a way to at least temporarily block that particular project. So I think one of the things I think we have to do is try to identify settings where constructive critical voices can be heard and try to institutionalize those voices in those processes. Because otherwise, I sincerely believe that if we leave this to mainstream political parties, both north of the 49th parallel and south of the 49th parallel, we're just in for same old until we ultimately hit some sort of terrible crisis down the road.
Well, let's talk about what activists have been doing, because certainly First Nations and environmental groups have been pushing back, not only in Alberta, but British Columbia is also key to this effort to not only expand the pipeline, because the tar sands have to find markets for that horrible crude oil that actually uses more energy than it produces, right?
Right.
So what has been happening there in terms of pushing back and seeking some of these places that you describe?
Well, I think in terms of what's really crucial to recognize here, Lori, is that when you talk about British Columbia, you're talking about an environmental group and a considerable portion of First Nations who don't have a material interest in, who aren't being subsidized, for example, by big oil. And so I think there's a huge qualitative difference in Canada between the opposition we see in British Columbia and the sort of opposition we see in Alberta. And it's intimately related to how tight the connections are between the oil industry and First Nations and environmentalists. So in British Columbia, for example, the provincial government is pursuing what unfortunately I think will be an unsuccessful court case to try to derail the pipeline expansion. We've seen, in addition, organizations like Greenpeace, for example, shift their organizing out of a place like Alberta into British Columbia in order to try to mobilize the public in places like Burnaby and Vancouver to oppose these developments.
Yes, What about First Nations groups in particular? And were you about to contrast First Nations groups in Alberta and British Columbia?
Yeah, the First Nations picture is a much more complicated one in Canada, at any rate, and I can't speak for the U.S. particularly well at all, but is a much more complicated picture than I think the conventional wisdom is. And what I mean by that is one of the things that I wrote about in the book is there are certainly within First Nations communities in northeastern Alberta important environmental human health objections that First Nations have been raising for years and years and years about tar sands development in northeastern Alberta. But there's also an important element in those constituencies that seeks a better material life. And imagine so we're you're in Portland. So imagine if in Vancouver on the other side of the river a big tar sands plant gets created, and then to the east of Portland another tar sands plant gets created, and similarly to the south. And you're sitting there in your community and you're wondering, well, what are my development prospects? I mean, how do I make a better life for my family, my children? Many in that part of Alberta have actually turned and have become principals in exploiting the tar sands in northeastern Alberta. And they've essentially been caught between a rock and a hard place. You know, colonial settler society decided that this was going to be the pattern of development that was going to take place in these places. And First Nations have had the difficult choice of deciding, do we oppose that or do we try to accommodate that in terms of trying to improve our material conditions to the best possible?
Right.
Now, in British Columbia, you don't see the same. There isn't that connection in British Columbia.
Which is why your suggestion for sort of moving the battle outside of Alberta makes sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely it does.
Well, Ian Urquhart, thank you so much for joining us today. And I want to remind listeners that your book, Costly Fix, Power, Politics, and Nature in the Tar Sands, is widely available, and we recommend that you pick it up. It's an important read. Thanks again, Ian Urquhart.
Thanks very much, Lori. It's been a real pleasure.
My daddy was a brakeman in Pullman in the strike of 94. He never knew nothing about the union, but he started learning when they hit that door. You got to roll, 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 roll with the union. You got to roll, 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 roll on with the wind. Show the folks how to tell the friends from the labor.
All right, that's a little preview of music we'll hear later in the program, as Norm Diamond interviews Rob Rosenthal, both involved with the 1980s rock opera Seattle 1919. They'll be discussing the Seattle General Strike as well as the opera itself and upcoming events with the Labor History Conference here in the Pacific Northwest. And thanks to Laurie Mercier and Ian Urquhart. We want to thank him for calling in from Canada. We know it's super, super cold over there, so Portlanders can think about that when we complain about our 1 inch of snow we might get later today. So let's go to Bill Resnick now, interviewing Kathy Wells. She's been organizing and managing a build-out of Lancaster, California's public community energy system. Bill Resnick.
Hi, Kathy Wells. Welcome to KABU.
Thanks for having me.
Kathy Wells is the Energy Projects Coordinator for Lancaster Choice Energy. Lancaster is a city of 160,000, about 60 miles, I think, northeast of Los Angeles. A lot of residents commute to work in Los Angeles, I understand. How many years ago was it, Kathy, that Lancaster City Council decided that their electricity provider, Southern California Edison, was not doing its job, was too expensive, and they decided to form a public electric utility called Lancaster Choice Energy? Give us the history.
Well, the City of Lancaster, we began looking at becoming a community choice aggregator around 2012. We officially launched in 2015, so it took some time for us to get there, but it really began under the leadership of our mayor and our city council. We started off wanting to be the solar capital of the world. We are a desert community. We have a lot of open, unused land without infrastructure. It's perfect for utility-scale solar, as well as putting solar on rooftops. And back around 2011, we launched a program called Solar Lancaster. We partnered with Solar City, which is now Tesla. But we partnered with them to provide incentives for all of our residents to put solar on the rooftops. And we set out a goal to become net zero, meaning we wanted to generate more renewable energy within our city limits than we consume. And that's kind of how we got on this energy road. And along the way, we discovered, hey, there's an opportunity here to become a community choice aggregator and actually control the energy that we do purchase.
That is, under California law, you had the right to, in fact, secede from Southern California Edison and take all the customers with you.
We do. We are the default program. So back in the late 1990s, when California did their deregulation and the market basically crashed, California government said, we're not doing this anymore. We're not deregulating. We're going back to utilities. But what came out of that was Assembly Bill 117, and that actually is to establish a community choice aggregation. So it's allowed by government entities or joint power authority entities. It's not allowed for individuals, individual businesses, individual homeowners cannot go out and buy their own energy supply. But if you belong to a community, such as the City of Lancaster, you can participate. And it is a choice program. That's why we're called Lancaster Choice. Although we are the default, which means when we signed up and told the state we're going to become a community choice aggregator, everybody in our community switched over to our company.
But they had the right to opt out.
Absolutely.
How many have opted out?
We actually are at 94% participation rate, so not a lot.
You were the first, but many, many other cities and counties and, in fact, regions of California are now community choice aggregators. They all take a different name, like East Bay Community Energy or Marin Energy. Now there are, 19, with many, many more lined up ready to get their proposals. Lancaster must have inspired many of them.
Yes, we spend a lot of time speaking at different cities and different communities. Our mayor, actually, he's traveled internationally talking about our program because we're pretty innovative with it. And what's unique about our program than these others is we're actually a city. We're a department of our city. So we're run by the city council. We don't have a board of independent, like these joint power authority groups, the LA County, for example. Each community that participates has a representative. They serve on a board, and they make all the decisions. Well, we are managed by our city council. And what's great about that is our city council sets our rates. Our city council tells us we want to be net zero, or we want to buy local. And our community can come to our public meetings and talk to our council members. It's really been creative. The other thing about being a city is all of that revenue that was leaving our community was about $60 million per year, leaving our community, going to Southern California Edison. That money stays in our community. It comes back into the program, and we put it right back out into other programs for our community, our residents, our businesses. So we benefit from that. So it was really a way to generate revenue. Yes, we want to save the world, but it's also we want to save our community. And another thing that we do is we actually have created our own joint powers authority to have other cities become a CCA. We help them become their own CCA. We don't run their CCA. We just help them do the feasibility and launch. And we've got 10 cities, actually, that are going to be working with us.
And I gather you're going to have a major role, at least, in that. Tell me about your energy supply. You said you're a high desert community. Mm-hmm. You really do get a lot of sun, and it comes right down on your homes. What's the percentage of your energy that you're using from some of those very large desert installations versus rooftop?
we manage our portfolio, right? We have to kind of stay within the parameters of what the state says we have to have, we have to purchase. So we have to have a certain percentage of local energy. I will tell you that most of the utility scale solar that has been built out here is used by the utility companies. They are the ones that built them and purchased the energy directly from them. We do have a local 10 megawatt solar system that we purchased the energy directly off of, and we had it built in our city. We're about 38% renewable sourced energy right now, which is wind energy. We're right by the Tehachapis, and solar energy, small hydro. So that's kind of some of the energy that we purchase. We also have a 100% green product that we offer. So customers, if they want to pay a little bit more, they can have that 100% green product. So we do offer two choices to the customers, but our base product is greener than Edison. We're 60% carbon free. That's part of it. And we have a goal to be 100% carbon free by 2030. So we're heading down the right path.
What about in transportation? We're talking about electricity use. A lot of the greenhouse gas emissions in any community are from transportation, cars, trucks, and diesels, which is the worst of the worst.
Yep.
Are you a plan somehow for encouraging people and subsidizing to some extent, like Norway and other countries are doing, the private automobiles, as well as mass transit is probably a city your size could have mass transit, it seems to me.
Well, we do, and I should tell you, we're getting the mass transit. The speed train is going to be coming through. They're working on going from San Francisco all the way down to San Diego, and they're going to be able to finish that. I don't know when the high-speed rail will be done, but as far as transportation electrification within our community, that is something that we're focused on, not only as the energy department, but also partnering with our transit authority, for example, Antelope Valley Transit Authority. They actually are purchasing all electric buses, and they will have the first, by May, the first 100% all-electric bus fleet in the nation. So we have 33 electric buses right now. They're working with Lancaster Choice Energy. We're developing a special rate. That's another bonus. You know, you control your rates. You can come up with an incentive program to get these businesses to adopt alternative energy sourced transportation. So the electric bus is a big story. In fact, the buses are built right here in Lancaster. We have a company called BYD, stands for Build Your Dreams. It's a manufacturing company. They build large batteries, and we're the first in the United States. Their first factory came here in the city of Lancaster. I think they came in 2013 or 2014, and they've got upwards of 800 staff now, and they're building the electric buses for them. They build them for all over the place.
That is a great story, because whereas people talk about light rail a lot, which is important, and big rail, in fact, if we're going to actually make the cities accessible, bus transportation is really fundamental, because it's basically has so fewer capital costs than laying track. All of the costs of rail, much of them are avoided. Electric buses and jitneys and various kinds of trams, it seems to me, are an important mm-hmm. part of the transportation future. It's great to hear that you're pioneering that. I had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole. I'm talking to Kathy Wells, who's the Energy Project Coordinator for the City of Lancaster, California, who in fact has taken over the electric supply function from Southern California Edison. They now have a city public utility that has 94% of the customers in the Lancaster area are with Lancaster Choice Energy, is the name of the public agency. Kathy, in planning for Lancaster as 100% community energy and helping plan these 10 other cities, I assume some of these 10 other cities are not desert communities or high wind communities. My understanding is that studies have been done to indicate that there is no county in California where the sun and the wind is not sufficient to create a great majority of the local energy use within the county. That is, smallish utility scale things, some wind turbines, a lot of solar, there's a huge amount of land wasted in cities and parking lots and rooftops, things that could be used to generate energy. Are some of the cities that you're working with cities that don't have this vast amount of sun or wind?
Yeah, some of our cities have not launched yet. We've got five of them that are kind of in a holding pattern. The state has told them you cannot launch until 2020. And then the other three cities are still fairly brand new, having launched this year. Right now, it's about getting up and running and getting their green energy and getting their program and retaining customers. But we are gearing up for when they're ready to start launching programs and start moving forward into introducing what you're talking about, which is distributed energy resources, such things such as solar, rooftop solar, battery storage, electric vehicle charging stations. And it doesn't matter, you know, we're talking about we're in a desert community, we have a lot of sun, and some of them, yeah, it's different. But all of these sources are volatile on their own. But if you combine them together, if you combine these resources together, for example, wind does very well in the evening. Well, solar's only going to do good when the sun's out. But if you have a couple of those together, now you've got some alternative energy, and you know, you're not as reliable to the grid. And that's what we're trying to do. Our new goal is kind of this grid defection. So what Lancaster's doing right now is we have a lot of projects that we're beginning, that we're partnering with, that we want to build and do a proof of concept. And we will take these projects once we know what works, what doesn't work, and we will take them to these other cities and show them how to do it. This is what you do. This is how you do it. There's lots of ways to creatively finance these programs because you're a government entity. You know, we have municipal bonds. We have all kinds of innovative ways that we can encourage this development. One of the things our mayor did, the very first thing that we did, is we issued a solar ordinance, which says any new home development within our city must have solar on its home. Every rooftop must have solar. So that has been established. And as a city, you can do that, right? The other thing that we've done is we've issued a net zero energy ordinance. So now any new development that is built, any new homes, must become net zero. So they must have battery storage and solar. It's a bigger reach code than what the state of California is actually requiring right now.
When you do it in mass, you can cut down the costs. When just individual homeowners do it, it can be expensive. But when a whole bunch of people do it in a contiguous area, it becomes much, much cheaper.
We're always sort of making these goals, these reach goals. We're pushing kind of the envelope of, you know, nobody's done this yet. How come you guys are doing it? Well, because we can. We want to try it. I mean, nobody's done it. You know, for example, one of the programs I'm working on is through the California Energy Commission. It's a grant project to develop Lancaster as an advanced energy community. And there's things that they want to see, such as a residential microgrid. We will have the first residential microgrid within the next 4 years.
Why is that so important?
It's important because, first of all, we're in California. We know we're going to be having this earthquake. It's going to be coming soon. But for reliability, it's for, not only does it save costs, it saves stress on the grid, but it's also emergency reliability. I mean, you are self-sustaining. If something goes wrong or if there is an emergency, you can disconnect from the grid and you rely just on your microgrid. You control the energy that you use, you control the cost, and there's a safety.
Kathy, we have to conclude.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, Kathy Wells, the Energy Project Coordinator for the City of Lancaster, doing such important work, not just for Lancaster, not just for Southern California or California or the United States, but in fact for all of us on Earth. If we don't deal with global warming, we're going to roast to death, and Lancaster has gone as far as any city can with plans for so much more. If universalized, that would end a good deal of the climate crisis. Kathy, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
You too.
I don't care about the government. I think Rockefeller owns the president. Just a shuggin' for the millionaires. Just one way we're gonna get our share.
We just heard Bill Resnick interviewing Kathy Wells. She's been organizing and managing the build-out of Lancaster, California's public community energy system. We'll be posting a longer version of this interview on our website. It will be up with the show's program today, and you can find that on kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Next, we turn to Norm Diamond. He will be talking with Rob Rosenthal. He's the composer of the mid-80s rock opera Seattle 1919, and they're here to discuss that and the 1919 Seattle general strike. Norm?
Thank you, Denise. I'm still kind of moving around the room to that last musical piece. That was from the rock opera Seattle 1919, composer Rob Rosenthal. We will talk with Rob in just a minute. I want to set the stage just very briefly. This is 2019, the centenary year, the 100th anniversary of a whole bunch of events in history significant to North America and to the Pacific Northwest. Seattle General Strike, 1919, that's being celebrated this week up in Seattle. That's why we're focusing on it, culminating in a bus tour of the various sites of the event on this Saturday, anybody who wants to go up there. The Winnipeg General Strike, 1919. Those are events we celebrate. There are events that we will mourn in the course of the year. The attack on the IWW headquarters in Centralia, Washington, again, Pacific Northwest, we know as the Centralia Massacre. The raids all across the country and the expulsions from the country of radicals of various sorts, foreign-born, the Palmer raids that destroyed archives, destroyed organizations. And there are events that we will puzzle over, like the Boston police strike, also 1919, strike by police in Boston that set back public sector organizing for many, many decades. That's the context. Rob Rosenthal, welcome back to the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thanks, Norm. It's great to be here.
I'm going to let you set the stage talking about Seattle. It's quite common, of course, for people to turn their university theses into popular musical pieces. I'm sure the opera halls, the repertoire are full of such examples. You clearly found something very important in the Seattle General Strike and something you wanted to communicate in a more popular form, some message you wanted to reach out. Tell, what was significant for you in Seattle General Strike, and what did you try to communicate about it in choosing a rock opera?
Well, I was very interested in the strike because, there are probably less than 10 general strikes in U.S. history, and the only one that moved beyond just striking to actually taking control of a city, that is establishing in the real world that workers' control was viable, was the Seattle General Strike. So I just thought it was an amazing strike. Partly I just thought it's the spirit of the strike, the defiance and the boldness of it really matched what I love most about rock and roll. But also I thought that this is a history that no one knew about. When I talk to people, even people in Seattle, most people have never heard of it. It is arguably the most radical event in U.S. history, and still no one had heard about it. So along with my writing partner, Mike Rawson, we thought we ought to do something that would introduce this to people who might otherwise not have heard about it. So that's what we attempted to do with the opera.
And did very well, yes. We will play some more of the opera very shortly, but I want to still focus a bit on the general strike itself. Quite an extraordinary event, as you say. It was pretty much uniform. All the unions, all the workplaces in Seattle, of course, was heavily unionized. More than 100 different unions. Each one of them voted, and each one of them, every single union, voted to support the general strike. How do you account for what about Seattle at that time?
Yeah. Well, I think there were a couple of things. First, there were radical groups like the Wobblies, the IWW, which had been a constant presence for the last couple of years before the strike, and who had been talking about this idea of the general strike. Really, the general strike comes from the IWW, and people had not, I think, thought it was imminent, but it was something that most working people had heard about from various radicals. But the AFL itself in Seattle was probably the most progressive AFL in the country, and they had been an early advocate of industrial unionism instead of craft unionism, and there were all sorts of radical currents feeding into the labor movement within it and also pushing from the outside. So when the moment came that it was clear that the shipyard workers who were, you know, during World War I, Seattle had exploded with shipyard workers for the war effort. I think a quarter of the ships that were built for the war effort were built in Seattle. And so you had this greatly expanded labor movement and greatly expanded number of especially shipyard workers. And they had been promised this raise after the war, which they were then denied. And most unions, I think, could see already that there was going to be a rollback or an attempted rollback by employers after the war was over. And I think just a lot of unions could see very clearly that if the shipyard workers went down, everyone was going down. And so it was a fantastic show of solidarity, but it was also, as these things are and should be, with a sense of self-interest, that if the employers could beat the shipyard workers, they could beat everyone. And so, as you said, there was this incredible sign of solidarity in which every union in the city voted to go out on general strike, which none of them had done before. This very radical event, and the papers were going crazy, and the politicians were going crazy, but nonetheless, they all voted to do it.
It's worth pointing out, of course, that the Japanese workers were organized in unions. They were not invited to join the general strike, but they did so anyway. They did so in solidarity. And the city continued to function. One of the most extraordinary aspects of the Seattle general strike is that workers simply took it over and ran the city and showed that they could run the city. That's, I think this is part of what you meant by saying this was a really radical episode in U.S. history.
Yeah, that's the amazing part of it. The most amazing part of it.
I think so, too. One thing to really point out, this is 1919. We're coming out of World War I. There's a vast sense of possibility that not only could the world be very, very different, but that the ruling authorities had failed. They had led us into war. And so there's both this sense that the world could be very different from what it is, and there's a need on the part of authorities to reestablish their authority, to reestablish their vision of order. And that's why we get both these outbreaks that I mentioned, like the Seattle General Strike, and the crackdowns that follow. What?
Right, and it's going on all over the world. I mean, it's in the United States, it's in Canada, but right, the aftermath of World War I, there's just people all over the world are thinking, that system didn't work for us. I mean, look what we've been through, and that they want us to go back to. And I think, and that, in, you know, there's the Russian Revolution. There's, but all over the world, working people are rising up and saying, we need a different way of doing things. And people in Seattle were very, very aware of all that. It wasn't new to them.
And it was a highly politicized atmosphere. It's worth saying that, of course, if you worked in the shipyards, if you worked producing the ships, you were not drafted. And so people from all over the country who were opposed to the war came to Seattle to work in the shipyards to get out of fighting. So you have already a politicized workforce. It's a very, very active community. There's soapboxing. There are people attending union meetings, something that doesn't happen much now. Union meetings are full. Rob, if you can tolerate this, and I think you can, one of my absolute favorite, all-time favorite pieces of music is a track that you wrote street speech that has Ana Louise Strong soapboxing. So she's out in front of the Union Register, the Union Record, it is, the newspaper of the time. And here's what you have Ana Louise Strong saying to the assembled crowds.
We built the pyramids for the pharaohs, and we're building for them yet. Oh, my sisters, oh, my brothers, we've been building for these others. I think it's time we kept it for ourselves. We don't want them, we don't need them. These parasites who live off someone else. Better turn it around, take another look. Forget what they made you read in your history books. Brick by brick, nail by nail, we built their mansion.
It's workers who make history. It's workers who make things happen. We can run things. And indeed, went out in the general strike in Seattle. And I should mention that inspired by Seattle, Winnipeg general strike, a few weeks later, lasted for 6 weeks with workers running the town, running the city. Rob, what you wrote has a through story. It's not just a series of songs. It tells a story. We heard one of the messages in the Ana Louise Strong street speech. Tell us about the opera and the story.
Well, the story follows a fictional guy, Peter Reinerson, although he's based on people I had talked to in my time doing research for my master's thesis on the strike.
You actually went up to Seattle and spoke with veterans of that strike.
Right. I interviewed 30 or 40 people who had been in town, who had participated in the strike or had observed the strike or who had opposed the strike. That was a really fun project that I did in the late 70s. We follow this guy. He's a Midwest farmer's kid. It's clear that there's not much for him there. He's the youngest son on a farm. He probably is not going to get the farm. And right as the war is breaking out, he takes to the road and meets up with all sorts of people, and he ends up in Seattle to work in the shipyards where he hears this work and meets radical people there and encounters Anna Louise Strong. And like many people at the time, he thinks, wow, this is really a different way of thinking about the world. So Anna Louise Strong, who's an agitator and a reporter for the Union Record, is very very prominent in saying we should be thinking beyond just striking. We should be thinking about taking over. That is the power in our hands, as a great labor curriculum book once said. It follows. Then Peter gets involved in the strike. He participates in the strike, after the strike ends, Anna Louise Strong leaves for Russia, as she did, and Peter stays behind to continue to work in the labor movement and to see about how to bring about a new world, which he's had a glimpse of during the strike and which he thinks is the future.
This is actually a nuanced treatment. There are songs also of discouragement, people saying, well, you can't pull it off. Workers can't make a new world all by themselves. Or the time isn't right now.
Yeah, we try to be realistic about it. I mean, we try to present the strike as it actually happened, the good side of it, the bad sides of it, how it ended, all these things. We were really interested in not just cheerleading, but reflecting the complexity of the strike and of the labor movement at the time.
We're going to see a reproduction of at least some of that opera here in May, here in Portland in May. May 3rd through 5th is the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association annual conference. Rob will be here, and we'll have local musicians doing some of the performing. That, to me, is exciting, and you've been very gracious in enabling this to happen.
Well, it's so exciting to think of other people, you know, to hear other people's take on how the music might sound and how they see it. It's a way of it going on in the world. So I'm really excited to hear it and to be there to witness it all.
Well, everybody, keep put that on your calendars. May 3rd through 5th, Pacific Northwest Labor History Association annual conference. Every 3 years it comes to Oregon. And this year it will be in Portland. Rob will be here. We'll have some of the songs reproduced, and he'll be doing a narrative to link the songs and tell the story of the Seattle General Strike. One very quick anecdote, Rob, one thing that you remind me of, and that's the Union Record. When people went on strike, all across in every profession, barbers, cooks, waitresses, everybody went on strike, the workers in the Union newspaper, which was a daily newspaper with 100,000 subscribers, the workers there said, well, we're going to go on strike too. Every other worker's on strike. And they stopped producing this means of communication. I've always thought that if they had kept it up, the strike could have lasted longer.
Yeah. That's a good theory, Norm. I think it's much debated whether that was a good move. It was, I don't know, morally correct, perhaps, but maybe tactically unwise.
Well, we're going to go out now with another one of the songs. This one you can imagine from the title why I've chosen it. Rob, thanks very much for being with us. We will very much look forward to seeing you and hosting you in May. I appreciate the plug for the curriculum, The Power in Our Hands. I wasn't aware that you knew it. And here we go with The Time Is Now.
Thanks, Norm.
Rumblings in the city, 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 city. Fear across the border. Crying in the country. Fire across the water.
Thank you, Norm, and thanks to Rob Rosenthal. That was a great look at an important piece of history, and we'll hope for more of the same from you, Norm. We need to see more of you here, Norm, at the Old Mole. So thank you. There's lots more to come on KBOO this morning. We have Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein. She's with her guest, Professor Paul Thiers, on the methanol plant in Kalama, Washington, proposed for construction by the Chinese government. At 11, it's exploration with physicist Michio Keiku. His guests are Dr. Charles Seif on prospects for fusion energy and Dr. Neil Shubin speaking on our evolution from the fishes. I want to thank our guests this morning, Ian Urquhart and Rob Rosenthal, Kathy Wells. We had Bill Resnick, of course, and Laurie Mercier handling those interviews, and Norm Diamond talking with Rob Rosenthal. We have Patricia Kohlberg, our engineer this morning, and I'm Denise Morris, your host. Remember to look for us on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. You'll find this program and many others there later this week. Thank you.